On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Donald Trump is probably the most significant thing to happen to the religious right in a few decades.
OMG, this guy is actually a bigot.
If she becomes president, no one since Richard Nixon would have been on the national stage that long and won the White House.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
Food is this entry point to anything that you want to talk about, and anything strange going on in the world is going to manifest itself in our food.
That's Eddie Wong, host of Iceland TV's Wong's World, and author of Double Cup Love, which comes out at the end of the month. Today, we're talking to Eddie about a piece he wrote for Grub Street last week called The Oppressive Whiteness of the Food World. Eddie, in the Grub Street piece, you take on the recent news that Nick Solaris, the restaurant editor at Eater, was in a right-wing skinhead punk band in his youth. Give us the gist of your piece.
Yeah, and first I'll say, I didn't title it. If I had titled it, it would have just been called Oi.
referring to
the genre of skinhead right-wing extremist punk rock that he did.
One thing that interested me about the piece was you open it up with the description of some time you spent in jail in Sicily.
Yes. The thing with that piece is that food is this kind of playground that a lot of people inhabit. Your role may be a cook, your role may be an eater, your role may be a writer or a politician. And food kind of, it creeps into everything we do every single day. And when I was on the show, I never thought that I would be able to go to Sicily, sit down for a meal of food, and then talk about anti-immigration politics, right-wing politics, and talk to Forza Nova, people who belong to the United Front.
So you end up sitting around a table with these guys talking about the arancino, which, talk about what arancini are.
Arancini is a fried rice ball, which people equate with Sicilian culture and Sicilian food, and is one of the trademark dishes. You go anywhere in Sicily, in any bodega, it's omnipresent, like Jamaican beef patties are in a New York pizza shop or a deli. They're like garlic knots. So we sat down and they ordered arancini. And I told them, I said, you guys, you love arancini. This is Sicilian food, right? And they're like, yeah, this is Sicilian food. And I said, actually, arancini is from North Africa. This is definitely food of the Moors. The Moors brought this during the invasion and it became absorbed in Sicily and it's become part of Sicily, just like our identities and cultures and foods. And so they didn't want to admit that. They were adamant that it was Sicilian. They were adamant that they were pure-blooded Sicilian and that they didn't want any other immigrants coming to Sicily because there's a lot of Syrians and there's a lot of Africans escaping to Sicily trying to find a better life and a better home. And they were extremely upset about it. And there was a passerby on the street listening to the interview, and he started yelling at them. He said, who do you guys represent? You don't even represent less than zero. You know, like, you don't represent Sicilians, so stop talking about this. And then they fought, and they said, no, we do represent Sicilians. We are pure Sicilians. We're the real Sicilians. They had it out on the street. Forza Nova, they wanted our footage. We wouldn't give them the footage, so they called plainclothes cops. And I got thrown into jail with the rest of the crew. And it was funny, because the plainclothes cops, when we were in jail, the thing they wanted to know about was like how to make hamburgers. They were super curious about how to make American hamburgers. And I'm there just like trying to get the embassy on the line to get us out. So it was almost like kind of a Twilight Zone moment. And all around me was just food, ideas and culture and everything.
And identity.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I heard that Nick Solaris was a former Oi band member, frontman, singer, I just Googled it. I looked it up. I looked at some of the quotes he had. He had some very, to me, insane and hateful quotes. But I believe that people can change. And I believe that restaurants are a great place for that change to start.
Before you go on, I guess we should pause just to say that Nick Solaris is the restaurant critic for Eater New York. not for the overall Eater website. Let's talk about, where do you place Eater in sort of this iteration of food culture that we're in right now?
It's a great question, and it's a great way to anchor this. There are more reputable sources that are print, New York Times, New York Magazine. These places have much more stringent, I think, requirements for reviewing restaurants. Eater started as an industry gossip website, and then they started posting daily news, daily food news. And in every single city that has somewhat of a poppin' food scene, you have an Eater, you have the local blogs. And these blogs have kind of taken the rug out from underneath the establishment food critics, and even I think the restaurants and chefs, because it is the easiest source to get your news. And whether people want to admit it or not, I think Eater is omnipresent in the food scene in most major American cities.
Yeah, I have to say that if I did a data dump of all the clicking that I do in a given week, Eater would be a huge number.
Yeah, and you know, for me, even like as a New York chef, I didn't know what Eater was, but then we started getting Google alerts for Bauhaus, and that's how we found out about what Eater was in like 2009. I started being, oh, what's this site? Oh, they're writing about us. This is cool. And I discovered it as a New York restaurateur and cook. And after about 2 or 3 years of reading the site religiously, checking it out because your friends are on there, they're talking about places in your neighborhood, they're talking about your restaurant, I was writing for them a little bit, I realized, I said, you know what? This is too much. I'm like way too plugged into the minutia of the food industry. It's more about gossip. It's not about food. It's about industry. And so I stopped reading those sites for the last 3 years. And people will send me links and I'll read them intermittently. I still read Pete Wells. I still read Jonathan Gold. I'll still read Besha Rodel and Lagai Mishan and the more kind of in-print critics. I don't know. There's a little more meat on the bone and it seems a bit more objective, but I have detoxed myself of daily news blogs. And when this news hit, it was actually an employee at Vox Media, a couple employees at Vox Media that put me onto it and were like, dude, I'm a employee of color here. I am, you know, of this credence. Somebody's got to say something about this. And they sent me the information and I was almost asked to write this because their hands were tied. And Nick Solares wrote an apology himself. Eater didn't publicly apologize. And so I wrote the article because I felt something had to be said. Number one, about what role these sites play in our lives, in the food industry. And then also what role bias has in this and how we can examine and how we can contextualize bias. Because bias is ever present. You're never going to eliminate it, but people should be aware.
And especially in this time where communication is instantaneous, you don't even have time really to digest or intellectually marinate on an idea before it steamrolls and becomes the trend. And then all of a sudden you see like-minded, like-looking, like-tasting things appear everywhere.
Yeah. And it's very funny because if you go watch Nick Solares' videos, he's very good on camera. He has a lot of information. But it's funny, even when he's talking about cheesesteaks in Philadelphia, he's talking about like, this is American. This is traditional. This is the authentic. And it's almost like he's talking about the founding fathers. And I'm like, it is apparent the foundations of what you believe in and what you grew up on. And maybe your views have changed, but dude, there's no way that your upbringing, your adolescence, and the things you did do not affect your opinions today.
Do you feel that Eater should have vetted him better?
Yeah, because if you just Google online, it pops up. His history is all there. Eater should know. The guy's been there for a couple years. And also, you know, Nick Solares knows this is something to be ashamed of. This is something people should know. And if he's serious about changing and his rehabilitation, then, you know, just make people known because people are forgiving. Society is forgiving. Like I had a second chance. I served felony probation for 18 months, year and a half, somewhere there. I don't want to say the exact months, but I was sentenced 3 years probation, felony probation. I served my time. I got off it. People are aware of that. I write about that. I make it known. And so people can contextualize who I am and the things I say and the things I talk about, I in no way want to hide it. I want to grow from it.
The takeaway for us about this whole issue, it's not to demonize him.
No.
Or say he shouldn't be doing the work he does, or that Eater is forever painted with this particular brush. What for you should the takeaway be for us?
I think the takeaway should be Nick Solaris needs to be aware of his past, be honest with it, make the public aware, and it's okay. You know, like, you're informed by your experiences and you grow and you change and you face challenges. That's fine with me. You know, Nick Solaris is not the problem. The information is the problem. And then Eater really has to vet people, because being a right-wing extremist skinhead, especially in this election cycle, I mean, this is something people need to be aware of. This is very sensitive. Like, there's a lot of things at stake in this country. And I think that there was severe lapse in judgment in not properly vetting this guy.
Yeah, and we should say that his apology is considerable and extremely heartfelt.
Yes, I do think his apology is sincere. I don't know if it's completely aware of how long things stay with you. And the ironic and funny part of it is I wrote this article for Grub Street about Nick, and then 5 days later, I published another article, which was the epilogue to my book, Double Cup Love. And it was about me being in denial of being in love with my ex-fiance. And I wrote the Nick Solaris piece really in that context, aware of that and having those feelings, because it's just like, man, you may be able to tell all your friends, I'm over this, it doesn't affect me, yada, 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 but like, you carry these things with you. As human beings, we carry these things. They're stains on our existence, and we have to deal with them, and they have to be known.
Well, thank you so much, Eddie, as always.
Yeah, always. Thanks for the time.
You can find a link to Eddie Wong's piece, The Oppressive Whiteness of the Food World, on the Good Food blog. While you're there, find out more about the Allowed event, where Eddie will be speaking at the Library Foundation of Los Angeles on June 2nd. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. We reached out to Eater to hear what they have to say about all this, and we'll keep you posted on next week's show. So this is to be continued. Up next, we look at how California's minimum wage law will affect restaurants and people working in the food industry. Stay close.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. You can find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts at our iTunes page.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Last month, California made economic history when Governor Brown signed a bill into law making California the first state in the country to raise its minimum wage from the current $10 an hour to $15 an hour by the year 2022. But what does this wage increase mean for restaurants and people working in the food industry? KCRW's Saul Gonzalez has this report from San Bernardino.
If there's a city in California where workers could benefit the most from a $15 an hour minimum wage, it's San Bernardino. Home to 200,000 residents, the Census Bureau says it's the second poorest big city in the country after Detroit. The median annual family income in San Bernardino is $20,000 below the state average, and half of residents receive public assistance. You can meet some of the people behind those numbers at San Bernardino's Helping Hands Pantry. It's a nonprofit that every morning gives out bags of groceries to many of the city's working poor.
Come on, take the airplane, somebody. You got bread?
Hope Alagi is the manager here. She says the pay many people earn in San Bernardino just isn't high enough. despite lower rents and a cost of living compared to coastal cities.
The low wages that we have, how can anybody survive under that amount? And they still have to come here and get some food because they can't make it. They just cannot make it.
In the parking lot of the food pantry, I meet one of those in San Bernardino who isn't making it on his pay, Robert Locks.
Well, I'm just working in the warehouse doing the temp scene right now.
And how much are you making?
$10 an hour.
So you're making minimum wage?
Minimum wage.
What is that like?
It's rough. You can't pay for any place to stay. So, you know, this is
you're knocking at your late model car here.
Yeah, this is home.
This is home?
This is home, yeah.
Oh, this is where you're spending the night in your car. So, you know, if your pay was bumped up $5 more an hour from the 10, I mean, would you feel it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'd be able to get a place to stay, you know. I'd have food on the table. I'd have more than just one pair of clothes, you know. California is so expensive, you know. It's just ridiculous. It's hard to survive out here.
But support for boosting California's minimum wage, even among those it's supposed to help the most, isn't always so clear-cut.
It would be great to say I'm making more money an hour, but if it's going to raise the cost of living, it doesn't make it any easier. It doesn't help.
That's Brendy Kanyes, Locks' girlfriend who lives in the car with him. She doesn't think raising the minimum wage is a solution, or at least a neat and tidy solution to their problems.
Because all the prices get raised in order to compensate for minimum wage being raised. So we stay in the same spot that we're already in. It doesn't get any better. I don't know what the solution is. I don't necessarily have the solution. I just know that that's not necessarily it. Just that in and of itself isn't it.
San Bernardino's employers are also thinking about the costs and benefits of increasing California's minimum wage to $15 an hour, including one man who owns a piece of American business history.
Okay, we're standing at the site of the original McDonald's, the Dick and Mac McDonald's, started McDonald's in 1948, right on this very location.
That's Albert Acura, who bought the original McDonald's site in the 1980s, arguably the birthplace of America's minimum wage service economy. Acura also owns Juan Pollo, his own small chain of fast food restaurants in San Bernardino. He says paying his workers more would hurt his efforts to help the community, and he thinks his employees don't need a big wage hike.
They've been buying season passes to Disneyland. The other ones are a new Apple Watch. And they're fixing their cars. They just went to Universal Studios the other day, which is, I can't afford that. But I'm happy because I'm helping the community. We have the lowest prices of what we're selling, the chicken. And then I'm providing jobs on this part of town. And there really are no jobs for young Hispanic kids in San Bernardino right now.
Now for a look at how people in a very different city are reacting to California's minimum wage increase. Let's travel about 150 miles to the northwest of San Bernardino, to Santa Barbara. KCRW's Jonathan Bastian takes it from here.
With its white sand beaches, its Spanish architecture, and its luxury hotels, Santa Barbara markets itself as the American Riviera. Here, the median home price is about $1 million, and the median income is about $25,000 more than San Bernardino's. In a city so affluent, what would be the big deal about raising the minimum wage? Well, plenty to Mitchell Shervin. He's the owner of the upscale Wine Cask restaurant.
We've got two new wines on the menu tonight. We've got Paul Lato's Matinee Pinot Noir and also Doug Marjoram's Sybarite Sauvignon Blanc, both available by the glass. They've already been printed on the special sheet.
Here, an 8-course tasting menu will set you back about $95, but that doesn't mean he's covering his wage costs easily.
The most unfortunate part as a restaurant owner is that you value your people. It's a hospitality business, and you want all of them to thrive, not just survive. But yet, at the same time, your labor expense is your single biggest challenge in the restaurant world.
Unlike the restaurant owner in San Bernardino, Shervin already pays his employees more than minimum wage. He fears a further increase in the wage will spark demands for even higher pay.
Imagine if you're a line cook and you're making $16 an hour. You just started, you're fresh out of culinary school, you're finding your way, and waiters making $10 an hour plus tips brings them up to, say, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year. Now, all of a sudden, you have to pay him $15 an hour. The line cook coming out of school is going to go, hey, wait a minute, I need $18, $19, $20. So the compacting of the wages is a big, big deal.
This, he says, could force him to cut costs, get rid of lunch service, cut hours, or even fire staff. And while this wage hike could hurt restaurant owners, the question is, will it really help workers afford one of their biggest expenses here in Santa Barbara? Housing. According to the Santa Barbara Housing Authority, the rental market is about 99.5% full, and a one-bedroom goes for about $1,600 a month.
Housing is very expensive. The cost of living is expensive.
One local worker who struggled to find housing is Cassie Huerta. She works three jobs, two of them at restaurants. She shares a two-bedroom apartment with three people.
I actually looked really long and hard for housing, and I got lucky with this house, but I had to have everything set, ready to go. Had to bug them, had to look every day and sign different leases as soon as possible in order to get housing.
I asked her if raising the minimum wage would help.
Not much, considering the price of rent and the cost of living in Santa Barbara. It would probably go more towards taxes, and I make more of my money with the tips than actually my paycheck.
So, while a minimum wage hike in San Bernardino and other inland parts of the state has the potential to change the lives of many people living near the poverty line, the effect it would have in Santa Barbara could be less dramatic. Restaurant owners may make a few cuts. Workers like Cassie will get a bump at their paycheck. But the rise in minimum wage won't address the larger issue at stake in California's increasingly expensive coastal areas, which is finding an affordable place to live.
That was KCRW's Jonathan Bastian reporting with Saul Gonzalez on how California's minimum wage increase will affect restaurants and other people working in the food business. Learn more on the Good Food blog. In a minute, we find out what's in season at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. It's time for the Market Report. Let's find out what Laura Avery wants us to put in our baskets this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. In case you haven't noticed, peach and cherry season is upon us. It's the time of the year that everybody celebrates. And today I'm talking with Karina Weibel. Karina has been shopping at the market as long as any chef has been shopping at the market. She is the chef owner of Canalay. Karina, what are you shopping for today?
Well, as always, we shop at the Santa Monica Farmers Market for the bulk of the produce for Canalay, but one of the things that stands out today is the stone fruit, the peaches, the apricots, and the nectarines, and of course the cherries as well, all varieties of cherries.
So when you say peaches, I know that we've got the white peaches and the yellow peaches. We've got the freestone, we've got the cling. I'm never going to remember everything. What kind do you shop for? What do you look for?
Well, personally, I prefer the old-fashioned. I think it's a sugar peach, and it's the interior is a bright orange with a little bit of red coming off of it. And I tasted it today, and it was just like so sweet, and it just tastes like summer. And you'll see as the season progresses, as we get closer into summer, also the prices become a lot more affordable. So, you know, you get your best on the seconds and you can make your jams and your crumbles and then you can just have a ripe peach, you know, a firmer one for a snack.
Yes.
So we're lucky.
Right. And what are you going to make with these peaches?
Well, right now we just put this on the menu, and it's not reinventing the wheel. It's the burrata that we get from Casa Ficio Gioia. And then we take the stone fruit, which is nice if it's a little underripe because we roast them. And I will add a tiny bit of sugar to caramelize it and a little bit of Bagnols vinegar. And then we just serve that with the burrata. And then I make with the cherries, I do like a cherry agrodolce, also a little bit of vinegar, and I cook that out. And so we just drizzle that over the top of the peaches and the burrata, and then some of our almonds here from Fat Uncle Farms.
Do you put it on a bed of lettuce at all?
Nothing at all. It's just the peaches with the cheese and the nuts, and it's great because you could have it for a first course or you could have it for dessert, which is great.
When you roast it, do you literally cut it in half?
I quarter them because what I like is to have a little caramelization on each side of the cut. So, and I only want to serve quarters so that you have another variety of fruit because there's so many right now. So we quarter them and then we caramelize them in our black pans. And then, you know, it's just like this luscious, juicy. We use a little thyme in there as well, so.
And in a black pan, is that like a cast iron skillet?
It's a carbon steel pan. And so that to me is almost like throwing something on the grill because we don't have a grill at the restaurant. So we get that quite hot. And before you put anything in the pan, we put the fruit in and let that cool the pan. And then a little bit of olive oil and then a tiny bit of sugar just to aid the caramelization.
Okay. And when do you know when it's time to flip?
When the color's there. Like it'll do the unstick thing. Like when it gets the caramelization right, it'll flip off easily. If you try to take it off and it's stuck, you know it needs to stay on a little bit longer.
That's so good. And of course you leave the skin on.
Of course we leave the skin on.
All right, Karina, thank you so much. It's always great to see you here. We love you. You're such a great market supporter. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it, too. So thanks for being here for us.
That was Karina Weibel. She is the chef owner of Canalay in Atwater Village. She's been coming here forever. One of the favorite peach farmers here at the market is Troy Regeer from Reedley. He's got really delicious, dependably ripe, fabulous peaches every week. Troy, Karina was loving on your, she calls them the sugar peaches. It's a classic yellow peach. Tell us what kind of peaches you have right now.
Well, the sugar thyme peaches are a yellow peach, but they're not necessarily a classic yellow. They're subacid, which means really low in acid, and they're more like a white flesh. They're sweet, but they don't have that full-bodied classic flavor. What we have for that is the Springcrest peaches, and they are outstanding this year. And we're starting with all the classic varieties right now. We'll be going into June Lady, which is one of my favorites, Fiesta Jim. Some of the Old Henrys are coming up in August, and Red Top and Elegant Lady, all the classic yellows that just are been around for 40 years and are fabulous.
You come down on Wednesday. Does that mean you basically pick on Tuesday?
We're picking really firm stuff on Monday, and then we're picking all day on Tuesday, the riper stuff, so we know what can make it that next day. Usually we go for 2 to 3 weeks on each variety. We don't like picking them all at one time and putting them in the cooler or cold storage because then it takes flavor away. So we try to keep picking tree ripe as we go for that 2 or 3 week duration.
And how do you keep the fruit from just bruising on the way down here?
We actually pick our fruit. We are probably the only ones to do it, but we pick directly into that Panipak box that we have. Mm-hmm. So it lets us pick it riper instead of picking into a bucket or a bin and then handling it twice. We only handle it once.
And some of the peaches I know have those little pointy bottoms, which bruise instantly when they're touched. Do you stay away from those varieties?
I try to stay away from some of the old time, like Babcock is one of them. You look at them wrong and it seems like the next day they're bruised when you get down here.
Right, and so you say refrigeration takes flavor away, so when we get our peaches down here, they have not been refrigerated?
If I run into an emergency and I have to pick them because I'm going to lose them and they're going to fall off the tree, I will pick them. But 90% of the time, everything is fresh off the tree, and it's just like they're meant to be eaten, tree ripe.
And how many times will you pick one tree?
Anywhere from 2 to 4, depending on what the spread is. And we can usually, like I say, get 3 weeks out of that.
You must have really trained pickers who know what to look for.
I got 4 really good guys. It's pretty small, but we're picking mostly every day. So we got other markets in Santa Barbara and stuff like that. So they're busy, and they're thinning and pruning when they're not picking. So,
do you yourself go out there and pick still?
I can pick one box, and I pretty much get tired of it. I'm not as tough as I was anymore, getting close to 50. But, yeah, it's hard work, especially when it's 100 degrees. Peaches are fuzzy, and they act like fiberglass. It gets in your pores, and it makes you itch. So it's like it's not a fun job.
Mm-hmm. All right, Troy. Well, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It's been this market, farmers market, has been really good to our family. And what have we been? 33 years now, and I started in high school here. And I can't believe I'm still doing it, but we've been blessed.
That was Troy Regeer. He is actually a second-generation farmer from Reedley. His parents, Jim and Norma, started the farm when he was a little kid. And he's got delicious, dependable stone fruit all summer long. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
You can find a recipe for Karina Weibel's burrata with roasted stone fruit and cherry agrodolce on the Good Food blog. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. And just a note here, I'm doing a dinner with Karina, Naisha Arrington, and some more chef friends on June 5th to benefit the Los Angeles Food Policy Council. You can find out more info at kcrw.com/goodfood. And as I do every week, we, of course, have Jonathan Gold in the studio with us. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. Hey, Jonathan.
Hi, Evan.
What part of town are we headed to today?
We're going to Little Tokyo, but it's not a Japanese restaurant.
What kind is it?
I think of it kind of as a Southeast Asian izakaya. The food is mostly but not completely Vietnamese. And the chef is Sean Pham, who cooked with David Meyer at Sona, among other places, and spent 4 years in Vietnam trying to rediscover himself as a chef. The name of the restaurant is Simbal.
This sounds like the kind of place where you just want to order everything off the menu.
It's the kind of place where, yeah, you basically do order everything off the menu. It's a difficult restaurant to find. The address is on 2nd Street, but it's actually on another street, and it's hidden up by the parking lot. It's very Tokyo-like in that respect.
So as you're wandering around, not knowing where you're going, do people start to point for you?
They don't, because they probably don't know either. But the hostess has a sixth sense for that sort of agitated look that somebody has at a table that means that somebody's trying to find the restaurant and they need to send out a rescue party.
So that means the food has to be really good to calm down those amped up Los Angelinos.
The food is pretty good.
So give us Simbal menu first time visit.
The first time you go, you're probably going to want their version of the pomelo and shrimp salad. They sprinkle coconut, there's ginger, a lot of crunchy peanuts. Everything there is crunchy peanuts. As a matter of fact, the first thing you're probably going to order is the fried peanuts with seaweed.
Ooh, that sounds interesting. Is the seaweed fried too?
The seaweed's fried too. So you get a big mass of salty fried stuff on a plate and you pick through it for the peanuts and then you realize that you want to eat the seaweed too and then it's gone.
Sounds good.
It is.
So are there drinks to go with this?
Yeah, there are cocktails, as in a absinthe-flavored drink served with skewered jelly beans as a garnish.
Oh, I love that. Is it a good pairing?
It's not bad. I think the idea was that absinthe is obviously bitter, so you chew on a jelly bean while you're drinking the absinthe-scented gin, and it's a different way of sweetening it.
It's fantastic. So food, I need to be fed.
Good thing we're in a restaurant. There's an interesting take on the Vietnamese bun tom, which is usually the sort of nest-like fritter of shredded sweet potato and shrimp. And here he does it as sort of a crisp fritter the size of a, I guess, a personal size pan pizza.
Like a giant latke?
Like a giant latke, but with that sort of loose texture of a rosti, maybe, that is garnished with poached shrimp. They sprinkle peppermint leaves over it, which is...
Wow, that's so unusual, instead of spearmint leaves.
Yeah, it took me a few bites to figure out what it was that I was eating, but it's...
I mean, pungent.
Yeah, it is pungent. And there's some of that sweetened fish sauce that you'd expect. It's a really nice dish. There's a bun mi salad where he takes, you know, the Vietnamese sandwich and he sort of deconstructs it into slivers or julienne of the pickled vegetables. The cold cuts are cut up. They toss it with, you know, the herbs, the rau ram and the mint and the coriander that would usually be in the sandwich. But instead of it being on a sandwich, they have croutons of toasted French bread.
I love that. It's sort of like the Vietnamese equivalent of an Italian chopped salad.
It probably is. The one part of that dish I could probably do without is the marbles of deep-fried chicken liver paste.
Oh.
Which would be appropriate on the sandwich, but get super strong and funky when you fry them. You can give them to the awful lover at the table. As is so much the case with restaurants, I was going to say in Los Angeles, but everywhere, this place got better in the several months since it opened. It was frankly not that interesting when it first opened. I think they were trying to do some kind of a take on the cart-driven thing that you see at State Bird up in San Francisco, which really works there. And here, never quite meshed with the izakaya portion of the menu. You were never sure what you were going to get, and a lot of the little salads and things didn't profit from being stuck on the cart for that long. But it's more polished now. The carts are gone. They seem to play Tribe Called Quest and De La Soul like nonstop on a repeat track. I was going there a lot the week that Fife died, so everybody might have been mournful, but man, they play a lot of Tribe Called Quest. Anyway, there's a lot of things that you're probably going to want to eat. There's like a rice porridge that's topped with shrimp that have been braised in that bitter Vietnamese caramel you may more associate with like the catfish that uses that. There's fried or sautéed nuggets of heavenly beef, which has been marinated in sweet Vietnamese spices. It's like the shaking beef that you see on a lot of Vietnamese menus. There's pork belly braised in coconut juice and a really nice plate of soft, not crisp, but charred pork ribs with a nice, sharp lemongrass chili flavor.
Were you impressed by any of the non-meat dishes?
Probably less so. I mean, there was a dish of fried eggplant cold that was sliced into sticks and sort of made into like a little log cabin with sweet Vietnamese fish sauce that was all right. But I think I was always happier with things like the bone marrow served with Chinese donuts.
Bone marrow served with Chinese donuts. That's kind of an inspired pairing.
It is. The donuts are the kind that you usually get at breakfast with your porridge or your bowl of tofu. And I suppose Pham's idea was that bone marrow has that same sort of unctuous slipperiness. And the other thing like that I really liked was raw prime hanger steak that was chopped and was seasoned with spices and toasted rice powder to resemble a Thai larb, but was served with a big puffy sesame roti.
Wow.
So you tear off pieces of the bread and you scoop up the cold meat. It's a nice combination, the hot bread with the cold tartare.
Well, it definitely sounds like a great place to go if people haven't already hit it up.
I think it'd be a great date restaurant, actually. Not that I go on dates, but...
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
That was Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Cymbal in Little Tokyo. Text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. Up next, we learn about a cookbook author you may not have heard of. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program Morning Becomes Eclectic can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app to get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I don't know about you, but I always want to hear how people find their chosen work. When I was in a room listening to journalist Donna Battle Pierce talk about a female cookbook author I'd never heard of, named Frieda DeKnight, I had to learn more. I asked Donna to join us to shed some light on Frieda, whom she calls one of her heroes. Thanks for joining us, Donna.
Well, thank you for asking me.
So who was Frieda DeKnight?
Frieda DeKnight was an amazing woman. She was a Black woman who was the daughter of a Pullman porter. And her father was a Pullman porter. Her mother was a traveling nurse. And she was actually born on a train. Her father passed away when she was 2 years old. And her mother continued to be a traveling nurse and moved her to South Dakota to family friends. And the mother would come and go. But she lived with the Scott family, who were caterers. And that was not uncommon all over during the period after the Civil War, as Blacks moved north and west. And it was not uncommon to have fabulous caterers and to go and to do wonderful hotel food and picnic food and reunion food and dinners for churches. And she fell in love with all things culinary by working with the family.
The family that she grew up with, the Scotts, did they cater for white families or for other African-American families?
For white families. They farmed and catered and made these amazing dishes.
Just to put this in a time perspective, we should say that Frieda was born in 1909.
Born in 1909.
And what is her seminal work?
She was such an amazing woman, but she wrote a cookbook that was, to me, an amazing cookbook called The Date with the Dish. And she wrote the book in 1948. I actually went and spent 2 weeks researching the places she had been and going back to find some of the things that might be left behind. She was in South Dakota. She spent time in Omaha. She spent time all around the Midwest, in Missouri, and then moved to Harlem and then came to Chicago, where she became the first food editor for Ebony Magazine. But she also was the person who founded the Ebony Fashion Fair.
This book, Date with a Dish, is fascinating to me because as soon as I heard you speak, I, of course, ran home and went to try and buy a first edition. And I actually had it for 3 seconds before somebody swooped in and took it away from me.
Wow. Yeah, they're hard to get.
And I understand that the subsequent editions of the book, which were brought out by Ebony, were a bit different. Tell us about the book and why it has such a huge importance.
Right, right. And in fact, when we were together at the IACP conference, the book was chosen this year as one of the classic cookbooks printed after 1946. And it happened to be that it was the book that Frieda did as an African-American food editor. But the 1948 edition, A Date with a Dish, 400 pages filled with recipes. And as I learned as a food journalist, because even food journalism, it used to be that there were home ec teachers that were contributing to newspapers and magazines. And then it became journalists, really not until the end of the 90s, that journalists were moving into that role in newspapers. And it's one that I did at the Columbia Tribune and then the Chicago Tribune. There's a style to your recipe, and it's a style that readers are usually not aware of. You always mention the same way how a cup is done and in the order of when ingredients are used and how you stir. Those, it's a certain style, as in any kind of journalism. And she adopted that style as opposed to a folksy or whatever style. It's a very journalistic style of food writing.
Could you describe the type of food that is represented so our listeners get an idea?
Sure. I have my my mother's copy open on my lap, and I'm on page 208 of the 1948 edition, and I'm looking at Ebony's all-in-one dish that's made with leftover lamb and pork and chicken and fresh parsley. Then there's a lamb casserole made with lamb shoulder. Then there is arroz con pollo, rice and chicken, Spanish style, she calls it, with a long grain rice and fresh parsley and rosemary. And Then there is a rice and frankfurter casserole. And I remember later in the book she mentions, because she also had a monthly column that appeared in Ebony, and she mentioned Louis Armstrong, who would say, you know, who loved red beans and rice. But he said, oh, you don't have to cook with expensive things. You know, I love my red beans. I think she's one of the first to mention that he signed his letters, Red Beans and Ricely Yours.
Yes, so we should say that the recipes are a breadth of dishes from cultures all over the world.
Oh, she had this amazing chapter called Collector's Corner. And in that chapter, she had gone and interviewed and had cooked with and spoken with very affluent and very prominent Black families around the country and included their names and a little bit of their narrative, a little of their story, and then their recipe. And so in this one chapter are these family recipes representing, you know, every region in the United States and bringing that to light.
Could you share with us one of your favorites from Collector's Corner?
Sure. She's in Louisiana and she has about 5 or 6 different regional recipes of the Gulf Coast of gumbo. And this is the one place where I went and found the most similar recipe to my family's recipe, which you never see those kinds of things published. She has a banana bread that is absolutely my favorite. I had grown up eating banana bread, and you know how now we have really sweet breads, and it's delicious, wonderful banana bread that you get. I'm testing all of the recipes that are in the book and reproducing them, and I just did this on one particular day, and it was amazing. It only had 1/4 cup of sugar, and all of a sudden, I was about 7 years old, and I remembered my grandmother's banana bread, and that's what banana bread used to taste like before it sort of evolved into what we think of as very sweet, which is also delicious, but this original one was served at ladies' teas and spread with cream cheese, and everybody I bring that to has a memory. Everybody of, you know, from my time, all the boomers that I know will say, oh my goodness, this is just like my mom used to make or my grandmother used to make. And if you think back to that time before school integration, this sort of plantation style cookbooks where you'll see somebody, a mammy person standing with a bandana, you'll see this was a very sophisticated, intelligent woman. She traveled all over the country. She met with white and Black food editors. And she met with Black cooks who lived all over the country. And she reproduced recipes that were more than just what we were calling from the 60s soul food. She reproduced all kinds of different recipes that had been perfected by Black family cooks.
She, in fact, turned her back on that mammy plantation stereotype.
Not only did she turn her back, and what's funny, even now, so much of the Black middle class has never really been appreciated in the sense that in every city in this country, there was a tremendous Black middle class. I have a family collection of photographs of beautifully dressed and different club groups and whatever from the 20s and 30s and 40s. And she found that in every city. And she went and applauded that, spoke with them, and everyone so appreciated that she was bringing this to the forefront.
Is this book by Frida DeKnight, Date with a Dish, is this a book that is found in basically every African-American home?
Of a certain generation. This book was the only cookbook that my grandmother had in her kitchen, and of all of her peers and friends and whatever that they respected as a cookbook, that most of the time they were family recipes people used or recipes that were written down. But this was a book that every single club woman, they were called themselves, and sorority women, college-educated Black women, everybody I know had this cookbook.
So was part of this book aspirational?
I think it was more that it was at last a reflection of a life that we didn't see anywhere else. And I think that most people who had it were living the life, and they were just able then to see this documented, and they were cheering Frida DeKnight on because she was doing this.
Because finally there was something that reflected their actual experience.
Exactly. That wasn't the person in the kitchen saying, even like the women, you know, from Popeye's chicken now who's on saying, you know, we love this. Here was an educated, lovely, well-dressed woman who traveled to Europe every year, who was a club woman, who wrote these wonderful cookbooks.
One of the things that I find so interesting, too, is who she calls the little brown chef. This illustration that is used throughout the book to bring us into the recipes.
My cousin was the art director for Ebony, Herbert Temple. And he is the person who created the little brown chef. As opposed to being a buffoon or all of, you know, the common characters that you see, here is a charming person who is a little logo to show that here is a chef who is a brown chef cooking for brown people. And not a brown chef that's cooking for the white country club or for white families, but a brown chef who is there encouraging brown ladies. And she often talked about that, that this was a cookbook written by a black woman for other black families.
How old were you when you discovered her work?
Probably cooking for the first time in the 70s. And I was going through cookbooks and found this, and my mom started talking about her. And so I started to look through the recipes and really didn't think that much of it. When I learned, too, that she had been fashion background, and I was trying to talk my parents into, I was explaining to them that I wanted to write about food and fashion, and that wasn't the thing for a young black woman to write about back then. Everybody was saying, well, food is something we're going to go past, and why don't you do something a little more interesting or a little bit more academic? And I used her as my person, my icon, and that was the reason that I stuck to it, that I wanted to write about this amazing food that hadn't really been talked about and this amazing history of the cooks who didn't really want to be famous, who wanted to be family cooks, but who had created these amazing family recipes that all of us enjoyed and shared.
What a pleasure to get to hear this story from you. Thank you so much, Donna.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
That was food writer Donna Battle Pierce. She writes a column called Hungry for History at ebony.com. You can find a link to Donna's recent work and learn more about Frida Denight on the Good Food blog. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Most of us remember the first food we learned to prepare in the kitchen. From Arlene Juarez, it was pozole. The 18-year-old from Boyle Heights, L.A., learned how to make it from her grandmother in Mexico, and she wrote an essay about it. Here she is reading 2 minutes of pozole.
Balancing precariously on a rickety stool, I curiously peered into a large black pot sitting atop my grandmother's stove. I watched as flashes of bright pink radishes and stark brown chicken danced around, occasionally peeking through the thick red liquid as it bubbled and steamed. The stew had a strong, spicy scent, and it provoked my stomach to emit a small grumble of anticipation. As I leaned forward, the steam made my face equally warm, and the soft sound of boiling bubbles tickled my ears. When I mustered the courage to venture a taste, I was immediately struck by a slap of red pepper, and the stew scalded in my tongue. Suddenly, I heard the floorboard squeak behind me. "Cuidado," my grandmother murmured. Her raven black hair flowed down her back like a sleek curtain as she placed her hand on my shoulder. I was 6 years old and visiting my grandmother in Mexico for the first time. It was the very first and very last Christmas my whole family spent together. My grandmother was making her famous pozole, a traditional Mexican stew. I enjoyed watching her buzz around her kitchen as she swiftly chopped onions, shredded cabbage, and set out a colorful array of additives such as sour cream, tostadas, salsas, and limes. However, I enjoyed eating it the most. My grandmother has since passed away, but her legacy carries on with each bowl of pozole my mother now serves every Christmas morning. Each delicious bowl transports me back to my grandmother's kitchen, where the walls cry when it rains, where the cracks have taken over the peeling walls, and where I still see my grandmother sitting at the kitchen table, enjoying a bowl of her famous pozole.
That was Marlene Juarez reading 2 minutes of pozole. Her essay was selected by Chipotle to be printed on packaging at restaurants all over the country. Let's hear it for this young woman from Boyle Heights. We close out the show in Orange County with a restaurant recommendation from Gustavo Arellano. He's editor of the OC Weekly and the host of KCRW's Orange County Line. Hi, Gustavo.
Hola, Evan.
What kind of food are we eating today?
We're going to eat Middle Eastern food, specifically Lebanese food.
and we're going to be eating in my hometown of Anaheim at Little Arabia Lebanese Bakery and Cuisine.
So many of the places that you talk about here are like dual purpose or three purpose.
They have to be. The way, especially with the ethnic enclaves in Orange County operate, unless you have huge numbers like, say, Vietnamese or Mexicans, you can't just be a taqueria. You can't just be a falafel place. The name Little Arabia signifies a neighborhood in Anaheim where it's at, Little Arabia. So Little Arabia Bakery, they try to be a little bit of everything to everyone, especially in an era where it's not just Lebanese and, say, people from Syria who live there in Anaheim, but Muslims and also just Arabs from all across the Middle East.
What are we going to eat?
The specialty of the place is, I mean, let's go beyond the falafels, which are good, and the kebabs, which are great. But you want to start off with the sfijas. Us Americans, we always try to make things into our worldview. So let's just call them Lebanese pizzas, your personal pizzas, but way, way better than that. And you want to start off, especially for the vegetarians, they'll like the za'atar one, the za'atar sfija. So we know what za'atar is, of course. This mixture, what is it?
Wild thyme, sesame.
The sesame, a little bit of oregano here and there. So just imagine a freshly baked bread, a flatbread, sort of like the size of a pan pizza, and then it's just spread with that za'atar. So you start off with that. It's the cheapest one. I think it goes for like $2, and it'll fill you up.
It's very, very satisfying.
It's almost like this new trend with pizzas, like customize your own pizza for like $8. So you could get one with za'atar. You could put it with za'atar and cheese. You could have some cheese and labne. Labne being, of course, I call it the sour cream of the Middle East. You could have it with sojuk. Sojuk being the, again, comparing everything, the chorizo of the Middle East. Then you have the labajin, another style. I think that's ground lamb, if memory serves me correct, but they're great. And they're pretty big. A lot of places in Little Arabia do sell these fijas. Little Arabia Bakery makes the biggest one. So one can fill you up, or better yet, go with friends and order a couple of them.
Are most of the things on the menu sort of bakery-based like sfija, or can you get other foods as well?
Well, they do have the platters. So you could get, say, you know, a fattoush salad. You could get ful, which is basically a better version of hummus. You have all those spreads, but you really want to stick with what's going on the bakery side of it. But what I also love more than anything here are the little empanadas, again, going with the comparisons, sambuseks. Sambuseks, people need to learn about sambuseks.
So what are they filled with?
Ground beef, but the ground beef, of course, is going to be spiced with those Middle Eastern ingredients. So usually when I go there, I'm tasting a little bit of cardamom, a little bit of cinnamon, a little bit of sumac, so just a little bit of spiciness to it. And of course, you can't forget the pine nuts that are mixed up with the ground beef.
Are they fried or are they baked?
They are baked. So they're baked. They usually, they make them fresh and they can make them to order. But if you want some to go, they have like a little counter, like sort of a little stall where you could get them and they're just warmed up all the time. Like think of a much better version of 7-Eleven food. I know. I'm sorry, Little Arabia Bakery, but the audience here knows what I'm talking about when I say that. But yeah, I mean, the best thing, like you could call ahead and order a bunch of fresh ones. And they only have two sambuseks. They just have the one with just the ground beef, and then they have another one with ground beef and cheese. But they're pretty substantial. You could probably get three of them, and that'll fill you up.
Anything else to say?
The great thing about them, they're expanding. It's a really big place, and they have a patio. At night, they're right next to a hookah bar, so they really want to amp up sort of the offerings. And, you know, going back to just this idea of Little Arabia and why I love the restaurant, they're trying to be a little bit of everything to everyone. So they also say that they want to start getting more regional dishes, like stuff from Lebanon that most other places are not selling.
Do they serve kibbeh?
They do have kibbeh. How can you forget kibbeh, of course? Theirs is fried, so it's a fried kibbeh. Bulgur wheat, the ground beef, and kind of looks like, Lebanese meatball. Why not? Fried.
It just occurred to me that since it's a bakery, all this stuff that you're going to be eating, like the ful or the hummus, it must be wonderful to have it all with a really fresh warm pita.
Oh my God. We're so used to in Southern California getting pita from a bag. Now imagine it steaming hot right out of the oven. I mean, you're seeing the guy right there going into their humongous oven and pulling things out. I mean, the last time I was there, one of the owners was talking to the baker, who of course is a Mexican, but knows how to make Middle Eastern bread like Joseph of Arimathea or someone.
Thank you so much, Gustavo.
Gracias, Evan.
Gustavo, tell us where we've been.
We were at Little Arabia Lebanese Bakery and Cuisine, which is on 638 South Brookhurst Street in Anaheim. And the phone number is 714-833-5760.
Thank you.
Gracias.
We've been talking to Gustavo Arellano about Little Arabia Bakery in Anaheim. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com, via iTunes, or anywhere you download podcasts. You can also find good food on demand on KCRW's mobile app. As always, many thanks to the Good Food team. That's Abby Fentress Swanson, Laurel Garcia, Camelia Say, Joseph Stone, Joel Stein, Jillian Ferguson, Ronnie Mickelson, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more good food.